time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Lyanda Lynn Haupt. Lyanda Lynn Haupt has created and directed educational programs for Seattle Audubon, worked in raptor rehabilitation in Vermont, and as a seabird researcher for the Fish and Wildlife Service in the remote tropical Pacific. Her writing has appeared in a variety of publications, including Utney, LA Times, Birdwatchers Digest, Open Spaces, Wild Earth, Conservation Biology Journal, and The Prairie Naturalist. She's the author of several books, Rare Encounters with Ordinary Birds, Pilgrim on the Great Bird Continent, The Importance of Everything and Other Lessons from Darwin's Lost Notebooks, Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness, and she is here to talk about her new book, The Urban Bestiary, Encountering the Everyday Wild. Lyanda, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks, Mike. I'm happy to be here.
So start out, tell us, what was your motivation in your new book, The Urban Bestiary or Bestiary?
You know, actually, both are correct. And I usually say bestiary because it includes the word beast, which is what the book is about. But bestiary is also fine.
Very good. So what was the motivation in putting it together?
Well, you know, there were several intertwined reasons that I wrote this book. The first one is really a strong sense of mission. I believe passionately that daily connection with the natural world makes us healthier, it makes us more intelligent, makes us more creative, it makes us happier. Science bears all of these things out, but I think we can also find this out from our own experience. The more time we spend outdoors and observing sort of a more than human world, the more connected we feel to that world and to ourselves. And so I think it matters to sort of share means of making that connection with others. Another reason that I wrote it, though, is just simple self-preservation. I have been a naturalist my whole life, a student of wild animals, birds in particular, and I always thought that I would live in the country. And instead, I found myself, you know, with a husband that works in global health and living in the city for good reasons. I, you know, believe in his work and want to support it. But I found myself on one level feeling really desolate. And so when I started paying more attention to the wildlife right outside my door and found that I could do the kind of study and with the kind of depth that I would in wilder places with animals that were closer to home, it was a kind of salvation is actually not too strong a word to use. So there's a very personal dimension to it. But there is one more thing, which is when I started putting this book together and researching perceptions of urban wildlife, I found out how much misinformation and fear and confusion there is among people that live in urban neighborhoods regarding the non-humans that live among us. So here we are in the first decade, really, in human history, that more humans are living in urban places than live in rural places. And so that's very new. And the disconnect between, I think that humans moving to urban places sort of felt like here we are in these human fortresses that, you know, are separate from everything else. We're finding instead that they're quite semi-permeable to non-humans. But at the same time, we're suffering this disconnect from the information that humans once had when we lived closer to nature. And so that disconnect is catching up with us and we're confused. I've talked to wildlife professionals who say, you know, God, people are idiots. They see a coyote and they freak out and they call and they want me to come and shoot it. And, you know, I don't think people are idiots for the most part. I think that we don't have the information that we need and we're confused about what to do. We want to be safe. And so I wanted to kind of calm some of the fear and hype and provide some of the good common sense that is required to live well and graciously as co-inhabitants with other creatures in our urban neighborhoods.
So what is a bestiary?
It's a medieval book form that I just became completely fascinated with. So there are these big compendiums of animal lore. And they were penned by, I mean, just the image that you probably have in your imagination is exactly right. So penned by monks, by candlelight, on huge pieces of vellum, which is dried goat or calf skin, you know, in these dark stone-walled monasteries. And what they were compendiums of knowledge of the medieval understanding of the animals that, well, what's really wonderful about a bestiary is that they're a combination of good, the best of medieval science, so what people could really observe about animals, but also what they just imagined to be true. They just filled in with imagination and sort of conjuration. And in the bestiaries, none of this is teased out. They present all of this information about creatures, the real, the observed, the imagined, the feared, as if it were all on equal footing in terms of equal factual footing. And so they're really, really good fun to read. I mean, some of the animals themselves are made up. So, you know, unicorn type things, but more like part reptile, part mammal. And they're all thrown in alongside the animals that you could really see out there without letting us know which is which. So what I love about that, oh, there's another level to the bestiary, which is allegory. So animals were always presented with a moral dimension to them. So, for example, you had a bird like a jay that was chattering away, and the moral to us was that we should just keep our mouths shut so we could listen to, you know, the spirit of God. An animal like a dove, who is very quiet, is able to see the devil of the hawk sneaking up on it, and so we too should be quiet and still like the dove, and all of it would tie back to a sense of God and scripture. Like the dove, we should be quiet so we should let scripture sort of sink into us. So I found the form absolutely fascinating. And what I wanted to carry over into my modern bestiary was the idea that compendiums of animal lore matter, that it is important for us to be intelligent co-inhabitants of our urban neighborhoods with the more than human neighbors. But what I also really wanted to bring was that idea that there are different kinds of human knowledge that all matter. So when I would look at an animal and want to learn more about it, just say something like an Eastern gray squirrel, I'd have to go to several different books, a book about tracking, a book about mammal identification, a book about animal myths, how animals appear in dreams and mythology and folklore. And I thought, you know, all of these ways of human knowing are beautiful. All of them matter. So I wanted to bring those kinds of knowing alongside our everyday storytelling and our modern sort of myth making and put those ways of knowing, again, on an equal footing. And so that sort of commingling of kinds of human knowledge inspired me from the bestiary.
And how did you select the animals and creatures that make up your book?
That was actually really hard because there are a lot of animals in the urban landscape and the book could be a lot longer. I wanted to be sure that each animal that I chose got some kind of in-depth treatment. So instead of trying to treat every single animal that we might see, I wanted to choose representative animals that showed certain kinds of lessons and treat those with some complexity. And so instead of treating both foxes and coyotes as sort of a top urban predator, I looked at coyotes as the kind of big, you know, carnivorous animal trickster figure. In terms of, you know, birds, there's actually hundreds of birds possible in an urban landscape. And so I chose chickadees as sort of the representative cute garden bird, and hawks and owls were treated as one chapter. And for birds, I did kind of a general chapter on bird life overall. So it was really difficult. And I kind of felt like anyone who reads this book will be able to say, gosh, you know, why didn't she write about blank, you know, whatever their own favorite animal in the urban landscape or something they've been wondering about. But I'm hoping that in looking at the animals that I did include, they'll sort of find a way into thinking about whatever animal is of interest to them. And one of the other things that I really wanted to have happen with this book was to see it not as a complete, you know, finished statement on urban wildlife, but instead as an invitation to participation, an invitation to observation. And so it's my hope that people will look at this book and go, you know, I'm going to do some version of creating my own bestiary, not necessarily taking pen to paper and writing it down, but by participation with observation to sort of come into this story, this unfolding story of humans and wildlife in the urban landscape, so that the writing of the bestiary continues.
So let's talk about a few of the animals that you have included in your book. One of them I was happy to see was the squirrel. Can you talk about squirrels?
Well, squirrels are really interesting. I think that they're the perfect example of the human schizophrenia regarding urban wildlife. It turns out when you look at studies of people's perceptions of urban wildlife, squirrels are the number one most loved animal, the ones that they think are cutest and want to attract to their yards. They're also the number one most hated nuisance animal. And so I mean, they're both. They have these, you know, we love them because they have these cute tails and these big wide eyes, and they run up and down our trees and sort of enliven our neighborhoods, and they'll eat peanuts out of our hand, and that's very cute. We hate them when they eventually, instead of eating the peanut out of our hand, bite our toddler's finger. And, you know, the thing that people most hate is that they come and they eat all of the expensive black oil sunflower seeds that the people put out for different wildlife. So I just love that we have this complicated relationship with squirrels. One of the myths about squirrels that I try to dispel in the book is that they're dumb. I mean, people, it's one of the most common things I hear about squirrels. People will say, oh, they're cute, but they're so dumb. And I just think, you know, where do you get this? Here you are spending so much money and energy and becoming insane trying to prevent them from eating your birdseed, and the squirrel is still winning. So how can you call it dumb? It turns out that they, in task tests, their intelligence is very high. They have a good, you know, sense of spatial relations. They have really incredible problem-solving skills. And if you watch them trying to get at the birdseed, you can tell that. But one of the things that I learned in reading this book was that their communication system between themselves is really complicated. And we hear their vocalizations, and if you kind of listen, you can tease out, you know, sort of baseline vocalizations where they're just sort of chatting with each other, and then they're kind of alarm calls when they don't want us there. But the main way that they communicate is by using their tails. So all those little swishes that they're doing with their tails are many of them are messages to one another. And they use their tails in all kinds of ways that don't have to do with communication that we can observe. They use them for rudders when they're jumping from branch to branch. They use them. I think all of us have seen a squirrel at some point fall off an electrical wire and then just get up and run away. And part of the reason they're able to do that is they use their tail as a parachute on the way down, and then they throw it under themselves as a pad when they land. And one of the cutest uses of tails is that they wrap themselves in it like a blanket on chilly evenings, and even cuter, they use it to wrap up their young as a baby blanket in the nest.
So they really have a lot of uses for their tails.
They do, and they actually also use them as umbrellas. And as shade umbrellas too, and actually that's what their scientific name means, shade tail.
All right, and in the same chapter on squirrels, you also talk about rats, which get a lot of negative publicity.
Well, rats are trouble, you know, because once they get in your house, most of these animals, if you have a squirrel in your nesting in your house, or an opossum or a raccoon, basically all you have to do is kind of wait it out seasonally, because they're there with their young. And once the young are grown, they'll leave and you can hammer up the hole that they got into in the first place. Rats are different because they have a very quick, you know, quicker gestation period. And so once you have rats in your house, waiting for them to leave is, you know, it's going to be a long wait. So we have to be really proactive about protecting our household against rats. But the human perception of rats, other than that, you know, other than them being a problem in our houses, which can be true, the human perception of rats is very odd. And I found, the more I talked to people, that it was linked to the nakedness of their tail. You know, rats, if you hang out with rats, Or have you, if you've ever been around a pet rat, you know that they're super friendly. They come when they're called. They're kind of like dogs. They hang out in your pocket. They hang out, you know, in the crook of your neck. They're, you can train them to do tricks. They're just lovely and affectionate and friendly creatures. Also super smart. And if you just look at their faces, you know, they have these nice brown eyes and kind of big ears. They're kind of cute. But for most people, it's the naked tail that they just can't get past. And they associate the maybe scabby or dryness of the tail with disease. They feel that it's dragging behind the rat like a snake, something that they can't control. And so people just have a hard time getting past that with rats. But I would just argue for, you know, if you see a rat, realize that they're a super smart creature, worthy of observation. You'll learn a lot if you just kind of hang out and see what it's up to.
And they're also actually very clean and altruistic.
Oh, they are. Yeah. There's some, they are very clean. I mean, they have a reputation for being associated with disease because of the plague, but that does not have to do necessarily with their bodily cleanliness. And here in this country, the plague is not an issue, and rats are busy cleaning themselves all the time, sort of like our cats, even more so, just busy washing, washing, washing. But there's some recent research about altruism in rats, which is just wonderful. So what researchers discovered was that when you put two rats into plexiglass cases, you'd have one rat in a small locked plexiglass box, and then another free rat running around it inside, enclosed in a larger box. And what they discovered was that the free rat would work very hard to unlock the plexiglass case of the locked-in rat. And then when that rat got let out, the two would run around squeaking and celebrating together. It's just beautiful. The films of it are really, really fun. And so they upped the ante on the free rat by... Now they've got the locked rat and the free rat. And so in with the free rat, they put one of the rat's absolute favorite foods, which is milk chocolate chips. Another thing that we have in common with rats besides intelligence. So the free rat might eat a chocolate chip, but almost without fail, she would save some of the chocolate for the rat in the box. And when she let the rat in the box out, they would still, the very first thing they would do was squeal and run around celebrating, and then they would eat some chocolate. And one of the things I should point out is that I'm saying she, because if you are ever locked in a box, you should hope that it's a female rat that comes along to help you, because I think it was 80% of the time female rats would free their imprisoned colleague, whereas with male rats, it was only 20% of the time.
Not a good showing for the male rats.
It's not.
All right. Talk about raccoons, because I encountered one two houses away from my house on the walk a month or two ago.
Right, just walking along.
Actually, it was going down the sidewalk, the same side I was, and then it cut up into somebody's yard. So,
right.
When it saw me. So.
Right. So so raccoons are everywhere in Seattle and most urban places, and they are for the most part nocturnal. There are a lot more raccoons for that reason than we probably think they are. But this season especially, that from spring into autumn, we'll see them more often during the day. And people freak out and think, you know, oh, they're rabid. There's this myth that a raccoon during the day is, that seen during the day is rabid. And we should all know, living here in the Pacific Northwest, that there is no rabies among the mammals except bats. So a raccoon seen during the day is likely not rabid. And if you're outside of the Pacific Northwest, there's still lots of other good reasons for a raccoon to be wandering around. The most common one is that it's a female with young. And so she's, during the time she has young, she's foraging for food much more of the day than she would be if she was just taking care of herself. And so it's not uncommon to see them wandering around, especially, you know, as more and more, as urban density increases and our interface with wildlife increases, we're going to be seeing more animals. And so the message there is just to use common sense. Don't feed the raccoons. When we feed wild animals, we invite them to become more expectant of food from humans. And so when they go to another house that doesn't want a raccoon, it becomes a problem raccoon. And that's when, you know, they get the fish and wildlife or the you know, wild animal removal people to come and kill the raccoon. So the best thing we can do in interacting and allowing these animals to flourish is to leave them alone and basically just avoid them. But yeah, it's a wonder to see them. They're really fun to watch. They're very playful. And they live alongside us.
They're very good with their hands.
They're super good with their hands. I think one of the things that makes us pay extra attention to raccoons is the fact that their front paws look very much like human hands. And the masks on their faces, even though they're fur, we sort of associate them with real masks and all of the cultural mythology around, you know, banditry and thievery and mischief that goes along with masks. And so between the masks and the human-like front paws, we misascribe intent to a lot of raccoon behavior. So raccoons come into our yards and they, you know, they mess up our garbage cans, or they come inside the cat door, or they steal the cat food, and people kind of think, oh man, that raccoon is really out to get me. And I think that with other animals without masks and without the busy little human-like paws, we sort of let them be as wild animals more. But it's important to remember when raccoons and any animal comes into our yard that they're basically after exactly the same things we are. The raccoons, even the ones that are poking in our cat doors, are after food, water, shelter, a good place, a protected place to nest and give birth to their young, and then protection for those young and for themselves. And so that's all they're after, in the same way that all of us animals are. But yes, they can do a lot with their hands. They can undo locks. They can untie knots. I learned that they could tie knots, which is somehow disconcerting.
They can open zippers. I had when I was camping when I was younger, they got into my pack. Instead of eating through the side or whatever, they unzipped the part that had the food.
Very bad, yeah. But it's better than ripping your pack apart, right?
No, it was nice. It was very. I actually thanked them for that. So, one of the you mentioned that people think squirrels are stupid. One of the animals in your book, the bird in your book that is often thought of as stupid, is the pigeon. Talk about pigeons a bit.
Yeah, pigeons get a really bad rap because I think one of the things is that they are so common in the deepest and sort of filthiest of urban places that we just associate them with, you know, places we don't want to be, places we don't want to go, a trash species, basically. They're called flying rats sometimes, so they get lumped in with that hatred we feel for rats. And then they have these heads that, you know, their heads just aren't that big looking. And so we think, yeah, there's not much brain in there. And I have to admit that I was sort of a speciesist against pigeons. I think they're a beautiful bird when you stop to look at them. And in fact, yesterday, it's so funny, I've been so busy, you know, writing this book and then copy editing it and promoting it now, that I've sort of gotten a little bit away from, in the last couple of months, from the central lessons that I'm trying to share. And yesterday I was at Westlake and I was hanging out with all the huge variety of people on that plaza by the fountain. And I had my veggie dog from, you know, the dog in the park guys that I love. And I was taking the, now here I'm going against the rules. You're not really supposed to feed the animals, right? But they're pigeons. So I'm not really as scrupulous about that as some people. So the pigeons were gathering around and I started throwing my little bun out. And, you know, as soon as now, two pigeons become 20 pigeons. And I just thought, I just took, you know, 10 minutes to really observe the details of each bird. And they're beautiful. They're iridescent. They have these lovely orange eye rings. Their feet are coral red. They have a lot of variation in their plumage. Their behaviors together are complicated and interesting. And they are overall really gentle birds. So it was fun to sort of just take that moment out from everything and just sort of sit with the urban birds and hang out with them and notice their the peacefulness that kind of brings. But yes, it turns out that modern studies show that they're a lot more intelligent than we thought. So there have been studies in Australia lately about their mathematical ability. And so they had these pigeons pairing cards that had, or images of numbers of dots. So there would be like a card that had two dots and a card that had four, and they had to put them in the right order, ascending order. And they could do this at least up to nine, which is amazing and uncommon in birds. And they did just as well on this task test as rhesus monkeys. So we like to think that primates are much smarter, but they didn't outdo the not only birds, but one of the birds that we consider to be the dumbest of birds, pigeons, in this test. So I thought that was quite wonderful. So one of the things that observation of urban wildlife does is sort of turns our preconceived notions of animals and our relationship to animals on its head, and our preconceived notion of intelligence and what the possibilities for animal intelligence are.
We've only got a few minutes left. Talk about the coyote, because typically we'll hear about these, oh my God, there's a coyote in the city, mm-hmm. Put the schools into lockdown.
Right. So coyotes are really kind of the flagship species in my book. And the reason is that they are pretty much the largest animal that is possible from the perspective of humans in the urban landscape. I mean, let's think about it. If bears aren't going to be hanging out in the city for their safety and for ours, cougars, no. Wolves, if there were any close enough by, that no. But coyotes are just, they're more carnivorous. They have more teeth. They're bigger than we want our urban wildlife to be, as much as we, think we like the romantic idea of living in a more wild city. And yet maybe they're just small enough to slip in. And, there is a place in urban ecology for coyotes. They, by controlling the, feral cat population, they allow native bird life to thrive. And they've discovered in areas where they've extirpated the coyotes that the uptick in rats is incredible. And so they are a huge, control on the urban rat population. And the thing, Mike, that people don't realize is that we have been living alongside coyotes since human settlement. I mean, coyotes have been among us for a long, long time. They just are wary of us, and so they stay out of sight. But you're right. People react with a lot of fear and a lot of emotion when they see a coyote, when for the most part, this time of year, it's important to think about that. A lot of the coyotes, mostly they're nocturnal, but this time of year, there's a lot of young coyotes. They're just kind of finding their way. They're learning what's what, and we might see a couple of more coyotes this season. So just calm is in order. And one of the wildlife biologists that I spoke to, Stan Garrett in Chicago, who's done more urban coyote research than anyone in the world, said that every human interaction with a coyote is a teachable moment. So he said, what we are trying to teach, we're trying to teach ourselves that it's okay. Coyotes we can live alongside them and we can both flourish. For the coyote, the teaching is that they need to avoid us in order for that flourishing to occur. And so he suggested, throwing a stick, yelling at the coyote, go away. And it's hard. We think that when we want to welcome wildlife, we want to, watch them or feed them. But the teachable moment here is, yes, we can live together as long as we, it's not, the peaceable kingdom isn't about the lion and the lamb lying down together. It's about everyone lying down where they're supposed to be. And so we need to sort of keep that peaceable distance.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. We're talking with Lyanda Lynn Haupt. She is author of the new book, The Urban Bestiary, Encountering the Everyday Wild. But you have a talk coming up this Wednesday.
I do. The official book launch is at Elliott Bay Book Company on Wednesday, the 25th of September at 7. I'd love to see everyone there. There will be cake.
And a bonus. So not only at one of the best bookstores in the area, but... great author and cake. I don't know how, and it's free, so I don't know how anyone can not want to line up for that. All right. With that, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.